from you first, I believe.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Omidari Jupiter. I represent the appellant, Mark Calhoun. I'm going to use my time to argue two of the issues that I have briefed in our appeal where we're requesting relief. First, I will argue that the money laundering convictions should be vacated because these convictions were based on financial transactions that were normal parts of the mail and wire fraud convictions. Then I will use my remaining time to argue that the conviction should be reversed and this case should be remanded for a new trial because the government employed purposeful discrimination in the jury selection process in violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. Your Honor, counts 2 through 16 in the indictment in this case charged Mr. Mark Calhoun and his co-defendants with wire fraud. Count 1 charges the conspiracy to commit wire fraud and mail fraud. The scheme to the fraud in this case, as alleged by the government in their theory of the case, was your basic mortgage fraud case. They alleged Mr. Calhoun and his co-defendants defrauded lender banks by submitting paperwork for home loans. Now, it was a paperwork package. Total loan amount was based on all of the paperwork that was submitted, and the government's theory of the case and the charging document in the case indicated a number of things that was done in that the defendants did in furtherance of the conspiracy. The loan package would include numerous false statements that would induce lenders not only to loan the amount to pay for the home loan, but to approve amounts for liens, invoices, construction liens. And that this money.
Now what are you arguing now? You're not arguing Batson now, are you?
No, Your Honor. My first argument regards the merger issue.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
And so, under the government's theory, these construction liens were designed at the very beginning for the money to flow as a normal part of the process to these entities. And this is how the co-defendants would receive their money. The co-defendants were not primarily interested in these home loans being used to be paid off to the seller. Although, I suppose, under the government's arguing to the court in response to our appeal, that could theoretically be considered mortgage fraud. That could theoretically be considered money laundering. The money laundering counts, with the exception of count 29, relate to financial transactions whereby the alleged false construction liens or the invoices are being paid off. And they were done so in accordance with what was listed in the HUD ones, by and large. There were a couple of counts that were exceptions.
But at the time an application is created, and I think according to the government's theory, at the time an application is created where the information on the application is false and where someone deliberately generates false information on the application, isn't at least a part of the act of fraud accomplished at the time the fraudulent application is submitted?
Yes, Your Honor. Similarly, at the time that someone places a bet in an illegal gambling operation, at that time, there's a violation of the illegal gambling operation.
But what you're asking, though, is for us to determine that the fraud allegations merge into the money laundering allegations?
What I'm trying to get the court to do is to do what the court did in Santos and what this court did in Garland, is to look at these financial transactions as a normal part of the scheme to defraud. In Santos, it was an illegal operation of a lottery in violation of federal law. And as I was alluding to earlier, the minute that you have someone taking bets, you have a violation of the statute. And what Mr. Santos was facing was an additional charge for when he pays off his runners, his bettors, and his winners.
But that's an instance where you're paying off a supplier.
Okay.
And so what you have is kind of your cost of doing business, your illegal enterprise.
Yes.
But here you have facts which would indicate that the fraud is accomplished at the time the fraudulent application is completed and then submitted. And then subsequent to that, at least a part of the time, according to what the facts are, there seem to have been these sham companies which received some of the proceeds which resulted from inflated, well, as I understand it, they would inflate what would be the sale price of a property in order to increase the amount of money that was loaned to purchase the property. Then at the time of the closing, reflect what was the correct lower sale price and then keep the proceeds which were realized from the higher amount of the loan. That's how I understand, I think, what the government alleges happened. So all of that fraud is accomplished, but then to get the money back to the co-defendants, there were sham companies and other conduits to get the money back to them. And your argument is all of that is just one single part of the fraud, and the laundering is all the same.
I'm saying that the money laundering is a normal part of the crime, just as in
Mr. Jupiter, you are looking at, we're going to give you a little more time, so you ain't got to be nervous about your time. You can.
And I've been asking long, slow questions, so.
Okay. Well, I think that it is similar to the pyramid scheme in Garland. This was a wire fraud case. The wire fraud was accomplished long before the investors are being paid off. There's no need for him. To accomplish the wire fraud or the mail fraud in Garland when he's paying off the investors to keep the scheme together. And matter of fact, this court said, in fact, it appears the alleged transaction underlying the money laundering charges could not have involved profits, and the only allegation was that Garland took proceeds from his criminal activities and used it to maintain the criminal enterprise. That's Garland 615 F3D at 395. If it's an episode, the government can't just be creative and saying, well, we're going to take this episode that's part, charge it with mail fraud, and then another episode, which is set up before the crime is committed, and say this is money laundering. That's not, Santos and Garland both seem to be in agreement.
Let me ask you one question, sir. They were charged with promotion money laundering and with concealing. And the government says the concealing is the easiest because obviously setting up all these sham companies were for the purpose of concealing where the proceeds were going, right?
No, the concealment was not charged in the actual money laundering count. It was only charged in the conspiracy.
It's definitely, even if we were to vacate the others as merged, you still have liability on concealing, don't you? Conspiracy to conceal.
I don't think so, because I think you still have the same merger problem, Your Honor. The other problem is that we don't know which prong the jury convicted under. So you still have that problem because there's still the question of whether they convicted under the promotion prong only. So that count is still in jeopardy of error. And we submit that it should be reversed for that reason.
Okay. If you got anything else you want to say? Did you miss a point that you wanted to make?
I'll let co-counsel address the rest of the points.
Ms. Epps, we'll hear from you next.
Hi, I'm Julie Epps, and I represent Larry Kennedy. And I have a case on the money laundering that we did not cite in our briefs, and I was not able to file a 28-J letter because your website won't let me do it right now till I get right with you. And it's United States versus Cloud. And I think it probably explains better.
Give the case and the citation to the clerk before you leave.
I will, and I'm going to file a 28J letter, too. It's 680 Fed 3rd 396. It's a Fourth Circuit case. And the facts are pretty much identical to what we have here. And here's how I see the money laundering issue. The government charged that in order to commit the fraud, they had to create these sham corporations in order to get these borrowers their money back and so forth and so on. That same fact pattern appears in Cloud, and the Fourth Circuit there held that it was part, all of that was part of the fraud, so it could not also be part of the money laundering. Because you have to, in order to have a money laundering conviction, the fraud has to be complete. So when the transaction that you were talking about, Judge Graves, the creating those sham corporations came into play, the fraud was not complete. It was necessary to the fraud scheme for those things to happen and for the money to be dispersed to these borrowers.
Well, isn't that an argument just that the fraud was not successful? If I submit a loan application that contains falsified information and I submit it, I've committed fraud by submitting a fraudulent application.
Sure, you've committed.
Don't you agree?
Of course.
And so the only question left is whether or not I successfully get away with it. And if it's a criminal enterprise, success means I get the money.
Well, no, because in order, see, you've got fraud. If you had a regular fraud where I submitted a false loan application to get money for me and I got it back, then the fraud would be complete at that point. But the fraud was not complete in this case until all of these other things happened. And it's not a question of whether, I mean, it was successful. I mean, it got the money back to these people. It was not ultimately successful because they got caught eventually. But each individual act of fraud was not complete until the essential expenses of the fraud had been paid. And that didn't happen until after these sham corporations were
Where's there any proof of that? That this was, you're talking about promotion there.
Right.
Right.
Well, I'm talking about concealment too, because you can't have either one until the fraud is complete.
And you're saying the whole transaction was not, the entire fraudulent transaction was not complete until the fraudsters had the money in hand.
Until the essential expenses.
Whether in their own name or through the sham companies.
Right. Because what happened, these shell companies were necessary that they had to be created to pay the expenses of the fraud. Part of
I really want to hear your Batson argument, but when you tell me the shell companies were necessary, they were only necessary because the fraudsters determined that that's how they wanted to get the money back to them. There were other ways that they could have used to get the money back to them.
Sure, there were other ways, but this
particular
fraud.
So when you say they were
fraud,
essential to the scheme, well, I mean, it was essential to this scheme because they decided that's how they were going to do it.
It was essential to the scheme, but it's the paying of the essential expenses of the particular scheme that the government charged. The government charged that was part of the scheme to defraud. That's what the indictment says. That's what they argued throughout.
Well, they're just talking about it as proceeds, and then the judge, tried to define proceeds as profits, did he not?
Correct.
Whatever that meant. But what? Then in some opinion, he wrote the profits are, you know, they were the same or something because they were, these were sham trends, the companies were sham. There were no services performed.
There were no services performed is not quite technic- technically true, but I don't, we're talking, I think the cloud opinion explains what I'm talking about.
Is it a wire mortgage fraud case?
It's a mortgage fraud case. The scheme was virtually identical to this one. The only difference was that in that case, cloud bought the properties and then resold them. In this case, of course, Calhoun got buyers who bought the property.
What's the implication for the sentence and the restitution and so on if these are for double charging?
Well, I think certainly the restitution would be considerably less, and I think that, you know, the judge would have the option to, you know, at the very least vary downward because the offenses would not be as severe. It's my time's up.
Okay, go ahead. You're taking the Batson case?
No. We don't have a Batson dog in the hunt. The other issue that I was going to take was sufficiency, but it's going to be pretty similar to, I think, what Mr. Knapp is going to argue.
Who is arguing the Batson case? The Batson case?
That would be Mr. Jupiter.
You didn't say anything about it. Not now. Do you have some time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, yeah, we'll hear you. Go ahead.
You know, our argument is very simple, is that the government used all of its peremptory, every peremptory strike to use in this case on African-American jurors. They, under Batson, the defendant is required to make a prima facie showing of purposeful discrimination, and then the government
has... What is your argument here, though? What is your argument as to why Batson is implicated?
My argument is that the quoted race-neutral reasons that were provided by the government were not sufficient to overcome the prima facie showing.
Why?
And
why?
The reason why is because the court indicated that there was an indication that there was a problem in terms of the differences between the education of the, and the reasons given was that there was a car washer and a person, an assembly line worker, Brookshire and Harris, those two jurors who were stricken, and the government did not strike a landscaper and a warehouse manager. There was nothing developed.
Okay, I mean, your argument is that these two sets neither had high school educations. The judge struck the black jurors for what reason?
That the government gave the reason that they did not have the education level. They felt that they did not have the education level that the jurors they didn't strike did have.
All right, and you're comparing that to whom? To whom?
The landscaper, Mr. Hansen, and Mr. Smith, a warehouse manager.
And what education, how did their educations compare?
Your Honor, I believe one of them did have, the government did point out that elsewhere in the record that I believe it was Mr. Smith did have, I think, a year, some junior college. But the others had high school educations. But the main reason that they gave for the differentiation was their job titles. And there was no questioning about these job titles in terms of what's the difference between an assembly line worker and a car washer on one hand and a landscaper and a warehouse manager on the other hand.
Warehouse manager, that he had a good title anyway.
Yeah, it was a title of a warehouse manager. Who knows whether or not Mr. Harris was a car washer who was the manager of the other car washers.
Well, you should know. Did you raise it with the judge?
It was raised with the judge. I was not the trial counsel below, but the trial counsel below did make the argument that this there was not, under a comparative analysis, that there was no educational difference between these four jurors. And the court basically gave as its reasoning that the government's race-neutral reasons were sufficient was that there's more autonomy in being a landscaper and a warehouse manager than there is in being an assembly line worker and a car washer, when they really none of these jurors were really asked about their jobs, what they do at their jobs. There's nothing in the record. It's just that these job titles were given and that landscapers and warehouse managers have more autonomy. And that was all that was developed in the record. And we suggested to court that that does not give, that that only provides a pretext in terms of why the prosecutor would exercise all of its exercises its peremptory strikes on all African-American jurors.
In other words, there were no African-Americans on the jury?
No, there were six. There were, the prosecution did have six. There were, under the court, did allow the government to develop in the record that they did accept six African-American jurors.
So the jury, go ahead.
What was the total number of peremptory challenges exercised by the government?
Three.
They only used three peremptories?
Yes, Your Honor.
And your complaint was as regards these two?
My,
against the gentleman who washed cars and the assembly line worker.
And the court did find that there was a prima facie showing of for Batson. And so our argument goes right to the heart of the comparison between the ones that they struck and the ones that they kept.
Well, and I would assume, and I don't know, I would assume that unless there were some special circumstances, they had a lot more than three peremptory challenges available to them.
I believe they had six.
All right, and they only used three.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Jupiter. Mr. Knapp, we'll hear from you next.
Your Honors, if it pleases the court, my name is Mike Knapp, and I represent Keith Kennedy. I would like to address the issues of the court's granting of the deliberate ignorance instruction, and that will overlap somewhat into a weight of the evidence issue. The court, when it was considering jury instructions, under the instruction...
And let me... Because the clock is ticking. Somebody's going to talk about the merger issue, though. Is that right?
I was not, Your Honor.
So that's a no. Nobody's planning on talking about it.
They already talked about it.
Your Honor, I believe...
Oh, I'm sorry. You're on the same... There's too many people here. You're on this side as well. Who are you representing?
I represent Keith Kennedy.
Ah, all right.
Keith is the son of Larry
Kennedy. I'm sorry. I'll catch up in a minute. Give him 30 minutes back.
Your Honor, the court, as part of its knowing instruction, gave the deliberate ignorance instruction over my objection, and I was trial counsel. And
you were court appointed, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, I objected, and the court did grant a good faith addendum to the instruction for partial cure, but my position is that didn't cure anything. I pretty much put the burden on us because no defendant testified. I argued United States v. Chin. The trial judge argued that Chin did not take root in the Fifth Circuit. Now, those were very close to his words. And cited U.S. v. Skilling. Your Honor, I've got the cases in front of me and gone through them fairly minutely. And the issue in Chin is whether, it had two issues. One, whether or not the purposeful language used in one section of a statute precluded a deliberate and ignorance instruction, and two, under the second statute, which did not, the second part of that statute, did not include purposeful, but did include knowingly. The court said that under the first 856A1, purposeful is inconsistent with deliberate ignorance, and it could not be used. On the second part of the statute, the court said there was substantial evidence to support deliberate ignorance. And in that second prong in Chin, fits in quite well with Skilling and the subsequent cases of this court. This court has addressed this issue several times. It's addressed it in U.S. v. Chin, U.S. v. Skilling, U.S. v. Nguyen, and U.S. v., forgive me, Bogoskowski. And these are all mentioned in the brief. All these cases come down to listing the same standard as to when a deliberate ignorance instruction is allowed. And that standard is when the defendant is substantially aware of the high probability of illegal conduct and he purposely contrives to avoid learning of the conduct. And the statutes, the cases all use that same standard, and each of them goes into detail about what the defendant must show in the way of, or government must show in the way of evidence to allow the deliberate ignorance instruction. The cases have several.
So, what is your argument here, though? I mean, why was it inappropriate here?
Your Honor, knowledge element of should have known element are the things that would put him on notice that there's something wrong here, and I'm just going to close my eyes and cover my ears, isn't here in this case. It wasn't there in Skilling in the first part of Chin, not Skilling, forgive me.
Are you saying deliberate ignorance can never be used to prove knowledge, or you?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying there's only certain cases where it should be given, and it should. And the cases uniformly say it should be rarely given.
I thought your argument was that you can never use deliberate and ignorance to prove a conspiracy.
No, Your Honor. In fact, my cases involve conspiracy. Two of my cases involve conspiracy.
Okay.
And that wasn't listed as an issue.
All right.
In them. So I'm not arguing that deliberate ignorance is, can't be used in a conspiracy or can't be used to show specific intent. I'm arguing that there has to be a factual basis to put the defendant on notice that he should have looked. He should have inquired. He should have done something. He shouldn't have buried his head in the sand.
Well, I mean, that was here. That was true here, was it not?
Yeah, I don't think so.
I mean, they allowed him to notarize these documents as a traveling capacity.
Yes, sir. There were traveling clothes.
They knew that he did not have a construction company, apparently, whenever they allowed construction costs in some way on one of these loans.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's been brought out in the the government's brief. My feeling on the travel loans and travel closings, if this was a fraud, why close something out of the office? Why not just commit the forgery there? I mean, you know.
That's a jury argument.
Yes, sir, I understand, but I'm just saying there's arguments to each of these. But in this case, we have Keith Kennedy, who's not shown by the record to be a lawyer, and he isn't one. That wasn't brought out in the record.
But he was a notary.
He is a notary, and he did violate the notary guidelines, and I admitted that in my brief. There's no doubt here, Your Honor, that this was sloppy.
Okay, Mr. Knapp, we're going to give about one more minute now to wrap up your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. In our case, we're saying he was negligent. I mean, it's sloppy. He did not comply with the Secretary of State's rules as to notary. He did allow these travel closings out of the office, the Kennedys. But when you read the government's brief, most of the indications, for example, it's implied that Larry Kennedy was told this by one of the witnesses. It doesn't have any of that for Keith. Keith did do the TUD ones, and he was aware of the travel closings, and he dispersed the funds. Can't get around that. That's facts. However, there was nobody, in light of the type of evidence in the cases I've mentioned, you will see that the evidence is very strong given someone that they obviously buried their heads in the sand. I mean, there was obvious notice to them. People told them about it. I don't want to hear it. I mean, it was just real strong stuff. That was not present in this case.
Okay, we get your argument. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And Mr. Cleveland for the United States.
All right, good morning, Your Honors. Gaines Cleveland for the government. I'm here with trial counsel Carla Clark. And let me cover a couple of factual matters that came up during the first part of the argument. Judge Graves asked, was this an inflated appraisal mortgage fraud? And it was not. And I just want to clear up that factual matter. It's discussed in our brief at page 8, footnote 3. Judge Jordan explains that their transactions typically began when Calhoun found homes for which the sellers would accept less than the list price. Calhoun would agree to pay the seller the lower amount, but then would arrange for unwitting purchasers to buy the property at the full list price. So that was how they generated money for the scheme. It was not through inflated appraisals, but through discounts that they were able to obtain the property for. There was another factual issue with respect to the Batson challenge that I'd like to go ahead and address. And that is how that process worked. The parties tendered panels of jurors in sort of an exchange of panels. The first panel was tendered by the government with seven black jurors, five white jurors. That's nearly 60% of the jury. And that compares favorably with the overall jury venire was about 51%. White as to black, and the government exercised two peremptory strikes during the jury selection until they got to the alternates. There were three remaining jury strikes available to the government. So if the government had any kind of effort to try to eliminate black jurors, they did not fulfill that. They could have used more strikes. So the jury ultimately was seated was six blacks and six whites. One of the jurors was stricken, was excused later on because of an issue, and was replaced by a black alternate. So it remained six whites, six blacks. Our position, Your Honors, is that the ample proof supports the jury's verdict, and that both Larry and Keith Kennedy were aware of.
Back on your Batson issue, though, you're not.
Let me finish with actually that. I'll round out the Batson issue. Yes. What we had was the context I wanted to bring the court's attention to, and Judge Jordan brought that out as part of his ruling was that if you consider all the factors that were available, there was no discriminatory intent on the part of the government. And our position is there's no basis for finding any clear error in Judge Jordan's determination.
What are the reasons you gave?
The reason the government basically talked about this is going to be a complicated case, and they wanted to have jurors with a level of education. Now the discussion turned to what were the jobs that the jurors had listed on the jury questionnaire, and the judge really focused on the role that people had in their jobs. You know, it really came down to this landscaper versus the car washer and the assembly line worker. And it is true, the record was not developed. I don't think you could find error based on the record as it exists. The judge looked at the prosecutor in the eye, heard the prosecutor give this reason, which isn't a race-neutral reason. And I wasn't there. No one, and I think Mr. Knapp might have been there. I don't know what the landscaper look like. You know, he may have been a little scrawny guy that he's the guy that was, you know, the brains behind the operation, I don't know. It's not reflected in the record. We just don't know why the judge accepted that the prosecution was willing to have accepted the landscaper with the same level of education as a car washer and the assembly line worker and credit the government's having stricken people who have equal education based on factors such as the job that they have.
Okay, move ahead.
All right. On the proof, we do submit that the proof was sufficient for either a finding of guilt as to all parties, either directly on the proof or based on deliberate ignorance under the circumstances. As to the money laundering, you find in your briefs the figure one and figure two that the government submitted, which shows that there is a distinction between the wire fraud conduct and the money laundering conduct, pages 7 and page 19 of the brief. These in turn line up with Government Exhibit 139 was a summary exhibit which lines up with figure one, and Government Exhibit 140 lines up with the figure two, which is the money laundering portion. So you have wire fraud taking place, and it's our position that there was no overlap in terms of a prohibited overlap. You've got money that's coming in as a result of the wire fraud scheme. That's flat-out fraud proceeds. There was all sorts of fraud going on in the fraudulent applications, as Graves mentioned. You had false occupancy affidavits, people saying they were living multiple addresses, going to different lenders so that you would conceal the fact that this was going on, and various other ways in which there was wire fraud. So the wire fraud proceeds come in to the closing agent, and then there are disbursements which are made, which are in anticipation of future transactions. So they're prospective transactions at that point. This is one of the key distinctions with the Cloud case from the Fourth Circuit that Ms. Epps mentioned.
What do you mean prospective?
Well, the money would be, a portion of that money would be going to down payments for future transactions. A portion of the money would be going to basically entice some of the borrowers to continue on with the scheme and participate in future schemes. So you've got two examples of how the promotion was going on with the money coming in from the wire fraud proceeds, and then they're now being used, channeled through these third-party sham companies. And that's another distinction with the Cloud case. In the Cloud case, the money was paid directly to the participants in the fraud. In this case, the money first went to these sham companies, and then they're now, money's then being paid for down payments for future transactions and to reward people for their continuing participation in the scheme. Looking closely,
that sounds like an argument for merger. Tell me why that's not merger.
No, there's not. The merger would be if the transactions were not if you were paying people as for essential expenses. I think you talked about it as being costs of the transactions. These were not costs of the transactions as they closed. You had the deals closed, and we're talking about money that would be going towards future deals, and that's why that is not an essential cost of the earlier transaction.
Well, let me ask it this way.
Right.
At the moment the proceeds were disbursed,
right,
was there a possibility that people could have received the proceeds at the time the disbursement was made and not have it go through sham companies and corporations to get into the hands of the people who they were looking to entice to continue the ongoing enterprise?
All right. Well, there was... payment to these third parties that actually did serve as part of a concealment money laundering. The conspiracy charged two objects, concealment money laundering and promotion money laundering. Payments to the third party sham companies served as a form of concealment, and then the payments were made for various purposes, including for down payment for future transactions and for payments to money of money to people to continue to participate in the scheme. Now, it could have been arranged differently, where the money would have been paid directly out of the closing in some way. But it quite frankly, it had to be obscured in some way. And the construction liens turned out to be a very convenient vehicle for doing so. The construction liens are typically recorded at the courthouse. Here, they were just made up out of whole cloth.
Well, let me give you an example.
All right.
Suppose you have a drug deal and you distributor pays the supplier who deposits the money in a bank account in a fake name. Are you saying that depositing the money in a bank account in a fake name becomes a concealing money laundering violation?
Well, putting the money in the fake name can be a concealment money laundering. It's not necessarily promotion money laundering.
Even though that is the proceeds of the drug deal.
Well, you've got a drug deal. The money is transferred for the cocaine or the marijuana, whatever it is, in the hands of the defendant. If you've got proceeds at that point, and then you conduct a concealing transaction to hide the source of the money, that is itself concealment money laundering.
And even if they, you know, I don't know. I think you're slicing it awfully fine there. And what's the consequence for the penalties that these defendants pay?
I do think Your Honor's question on that is apt. I don't think that there's a consequence. You've got a concealment money laundering charge. You've got a promotion money laundering. The conspiracy charge is there, I think, any way you look at it. And as long as there is a money laundering charge, the individual counts of money laundering, there would be a reduction in, you know, the supervised release terms, which could be available. I don't recall whether they were run.
Well, under this, money laundering, a conspiracy. If the conspiracy stands, then I suspect they're stuck. But I mean, money laundering carries much higher prospective penalties than
that is true.
Fraud does. So
that's exactly right. So long as there is at least one, the conspiracy, I think everything else comes in as relevant conduct. But there's a dramatic difference. If the case were to proceed only on the wire fraud and not the money laundering. But we do think, and we'd like the court to look at the proof in light of the case law. The Garland case, I think, lays it out that this would satisfy the standard. Now, one of the key things is Judge Jordan was very careful in how he instructed the jury. He said, I'm going to go ahead and give a proceeds means profits instruction. So he gave an instruction that cures, in essence, any kind of a merger problem. Because if there is a merger problem, you deal with it by treating.
What's the merger problem he was looking to cure when he gave that instruction?
I think he was acting out of an abundance of caution. The law in the circuit had not been the Garland decision, I think, was fairly recent at that point. I think he was being extra cautious, and he said so.
No, what was the problem though?
Just the claim that the defense made that there was an undue overlap in the transactions, and we argue that.
And you think that definition cures it?
The definition says to look at the proceeds, and if there's a modicum of profit, that is satisfactory. The government offered much more than a modicum of profit. All of the third-party transactions were shams. That was just pure profit. There were no services rendered, and in the overall scheme, this was a very profitable scheme with very low cost. So I think that we would easily satisfy even a net profits standard, which is what the concern was in Santos.
And so the amount of the profit justifies a separate money laundering charge. Is that that your argument?
It's the money. We have to be able to show that there was a completed transaction of a wire fraud in this case, and that the defendants in turn took that money or a portion of that money and plowed it back into the scheme in a promotion money laundering type fashion, or that they concealed the money in this case by paying it to third party sham companies. So we have money laundering, and then the only question is, was it in a sufficient What about the proceeds? Were these proceeds? And the question in Santos is, you've got to look at the net proceeds, and is that going to be enough? And our position is, we easily satisfy the instruction that Judge Durden gave. So regardless of a merger issue, we still are covered because of how profitable.
No, I noticed. Yes.
How do you distinguish this from the Garland case?
Well, we have these were not essential expenses of the conduct.
But that was a Ponzi scheme, right?
That's right. That was a Ponzi scheme.
And so I presume that part of the money laundering charge was that he was taking the money from the, you know, from the new investors and paying it back to the old investors, right?
That's right.
Which is exactly what part of your charge is.
Well, that the part of that is promotion money laundering, but we also have the down payments that are going towards. No borrower was out of pocket.
And by the way, they did say that, or somebody said in their brief, that the government never argued that the payments to the borrower, to the new investors to keep the scheme going, were part of the money laundering.
I'm not sure that's necessarily Kate. So it's in the proof, and the court can consider the proof whether it was argued or not. And our position is that
we can invent a theory that the government didn't adduce, though.
The government theory was that this was promotion money laundering.
Right.
And this is there are examples of how that was accomplished.
But there's not a single example in the indictment, in the pages of the indictment, that involves paying a new investor. It's all money taken from borrower one and paid to sham corporation. Those are the only substantive counts.
I would call the court's attention to there was a 404B issue in this case, and it involved how the government was fleshing out the transactions. And the defense was saying, this is 404B for the government to flesh out these transactions by showing money going here and money going there. And they're the same sort of transactions that we're talking about. And the judge said the defense is on ample notice that the government is proceeding on this theory, that these are associated transactions.
So it was a constructive indictment.
No, this is not a constructive indictment. These are subsets. Basically a subset of the charged conduct.
Well, you can't go on 404B and prove one crime, prove the crime not indicted by means of the 404B crime.
Well, the crime indicted was promotion money laundering.
I understand that's what it said, right. But then the substantive counts of promotion,
right.
Unless I misread this part of the indictment, all involved a check going to a sham construction company or whatever, third-party
right.
company, using the proceeds of the loan to borrower 1, borrower
right.
12, borrower 55, etc.
So, well, let me make 2 points. One is there was, obviously, we had the conspiracy charge, so that could be fleshed out. You can have uncharged overt acts in support of a conspiracy, and that was part of the series of transactions that the defense raised questions about on a 404B front. And I mentioned the 404B only because it illustrates that the defense was fully aware of this, and that's one of the constructive amendment type concerns, is was everyone aware of the same conduct, and we submit that it was. And there also was, with respect to the charge transactions, some illustration of how the money goes from the mortgage company, the lender, to the closing agent in the wire fraud. That's a wire fraud, and I think you can look at the case law that goes to what is a completed wire fraud transaction. It's when in various respects. But then you go downstream from that is money from the closing agent to the third-party sham companies.
Well, and I'm saying those are the only things that are in the indictment.
Right. Those we submit are in anticipation of paying money for things like down payments, for future transactions, and for looking prospectively to pay
but
borrowers.
You're arguing those are concealing money laundering.
We argue that they can be more than one. There can be one more than one purpose.
So if
for
it
the
can
payment.
Be the same payment and it can be indicted as either promotion or concealing and therefore generate two different two different prison terms?
Well, we didn't charge it that way. We charged it as a conspiracy with two objects.
I understand. Well, you're not talking about conspiracy and not the...
I'm talking about the substantive money laundering front of the promotion money laundering. Those transactions were anticipation of transfers downstream, which would go towards future borrowers being rewarded and towards down payments for future transactions.
Are you conceding that everything that happened after the loan closing in terms of money going into the sham corporations and back to, investors, potential borrowers, is all of that an essential part of the scheme?
No, we would argue that it's not. The borrowers went into this really, by and large, expecting the property to increase in value, as anybody wanting to get into an investment. They were enticed into it because they didn't have to put up any money. So that was one of the enticements. It turns out that when people participated in multiple transactions, including a James Bailey, he describes, what he was expecting to get out of the deal, and he's looking towards the future appreciation of the property. He participates in a total of, I think, four transactions. First one, he doesn't get paid a dime in terms of any money coming back to him, so that's clearly not an essential expense of the original transaction in which he participates. The second one, I think he gets $20,000, and then a little return on his money directly from Calhoun through one of the sham transaction, third-party company transactions. And then he goes on and participates in yet another deal and maybe another one after that, and he gets nothing out of it, any kind of a direct payment. So people did not go into this, the investors, the borrowers, anticipating to get any specific amount of money. In some cases, they weren't getting any money at all except for the prospect of perhaps getting return later down the line. So it's very different from people who were going into transactions expecting to get a return in the way of direct payments, such as in the case that Ms. Epps cited.
The one thing I noticed that there was a forfeiture of $10 million. Was that money that he had made? Did he have to forfeit $10 million of his own money? It's not part of this case, but...
It was a money judgment, Your Honor. That was not actually money forfeited. It was in terms of a money judgment. Oftentimes Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, thank you. And we have some time for rebuttal here. Ms. Epps?
I want to talk just real briefly about the inferences that you have to draw to get to the conclusions that the government wants you to reach on the deliberate ignorance and sufficiency thing. And the... I'll start with the travel closings and the occupancy agreements. In order to infer that the Kennedys should have been suspicious that fraud was taking place, you have to be able to first infer that the Kennedys would have had some reason to believe that these people were not really signing these documents. Now, there's no question that you're not supposed to notarize a document that you don't see the signatory for. But people do it all the time, and it's not fraud. It's not a crime. It's a civil problem, but it's not a crime. So in order to be able to infer that the Kennedys should have known that something evil was afoot, they would have to know that the signatures were false. Well, there's evidence in the record that Tierlin Rankin sent out the closing packages to all of these people, and not a single one of them ever complained about it, admitted they received them, and never called the Kennedys and said, what loan? What signature? So you got to make some leaps there to get to the Kennedys doing that. And that's the case in several of these instances. The other problem is that the government throughout conflates, puts the two Kennedys together, and asks you to impute one of the knowledge of one of them to the other. An example of that is the Jason Ellis thing, where Jason Ellis came in and said, I want to see more fast start mortgages. He said that, although that was stricken, but assuming that he said it for the sake of argument, said to Larry Kennedy. It was not said to Keith Kennedy. And the only mortgage that I can find that came after that that had fast start on it was Mark Calhoun's own loan, and that was closed by Keith Kennedy. So in order to find that either one of them knew about the Jason Ellis and then the fast start closure, you've got to, you know, in other words, Larry wouldn't have known about the subsequent fast start, and Keith wouldn't have known about the Jason Ellis conversation. So okay. You have all sorts of problems like that.
Okay, wind it down, Ms. Ellis.
I would hope that the court would look at you mentioned the not having a construction company. Actually, Willie Jones did have a construction company. So it's not true that, you know, they would have suspected that the liens were not for real construction work, because Willie Jones did in fact have a construction company.
How many loans were involved in this? Dozens, right?
I think it was probably ended up being about 20.
Indicted?
That's my recollection.
But there were a lot more involved in the scheme, weren't there?
Well, they did put some more on its 404B.
You can't get to $10 million in restitution from 2020.
Oh, well, they put that on its sentencing.
I understand that. But I'm saying if that's the amount of loss, there must have been hundreds of loans.
I don't think so. If you look at the list in the pre-sentence report, there's a list in the pre-sentence report, and there's nowhere near 100.
Okay, Ms. Epps, thank you. And we will hear from Mr. Knapp, who said 1 minute for rebuttal.
Your Honor, please, the court again. I noticed that the government has barely mentioned the deliberate ignorance instruction, and I would just ask the court again to compare the facts of this case with the facts of the cases I've cited. And although in this case there was negligence, sloppiness, and shortcuts taken, it does not rise to the level of the facts in the cases that I've cited before this court, that this court has decided previously. I'd also like to point out that the evidence in this trial alone showed the Kennedys got no money other than their fees and, of course, title insurance payments and recording costs, but they got no money was shown to go to either Kennedy except for their fees. That was about $21,000, I think the evidence showed. And that's really all I wanted to bring to the court.
Okay, Mr. Knapp, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.